rhetorical question. Abdullah was clearly taking his time, but the chopper quickly overtook the walking masses and set down about 100 feet from the stage, whipping up a cloud of dust that a light breeze carried directly to the people on the platform. They stared at the chopper. Mac saw several armed GC looking and talking among themselves. One approached. A young, thick-chested man who would have been stocky even without the bulletproof vest that became apparent as he drew near. Abdullah had shut down, and the blade had just stopped. "Just sit here and look at him," Mac said. "Make him make the first move." Vest Chest stood with his weapon dangling, totally non-threatening, but he looked expectantly at Albie, who sat in the second seat by the door. "You going to open up?" the young man said. "Not if we don't have to," Albie said. "The AC still has this thing cooled." "You have to," the peacekeeper said. Albie looked back at Mac. Mac nodded. Albie opened the door. Mac leaned forward and spoke in a gruff voice. "You don't want to be too close to this machine, son. Engine's still hot, and she's been known to spit some oil. And we might want to fire her up again just for a little air." "What's your business here?" "Same as yours. Security. Monitoring. Now I'm going to have to ask you to back away from the craft." It was gutsy, but after what Mac had been through the last year, to him it was like a walk in the park. If the guy wanted to get into a contest of wills, Mac would stall him long enough for Smitty to get the engine roaring again, and they would be out of there. Of course, even small weapons fire could bring down a chopper from close range, but maybe planting in his mind about the spitting of hot oil would give the GC pause. Mac's ruse worked. The man just nodded and backed off. "Start her up, Smitty," Mac said. "Gotta give him a reason to concede." The dust blew again. Abdullah shut down quickly. The GC returned. Mac took the offensive. He leaned past Albie and opened the door himself. "Don't worry," he said. "That's the last time we do that till we leave. We don't want to get people dusty or keep them from hearing or anything, okay?" "Just what I was going to say, sir." Mac gave him an index finger salute, and the people began showing up, already looking exhausted. It took only a few minutes for the crowd to gather, and it appeared that an otherwise normal-looking guy, whom Mac thought looked like a younger version of Leon Fortunato, grabbed the microphone. He wore white shoes, white slacks, a white shirt, and sounded like a motivational speaker, all peppy and crisp. He said he was the whole show, announcer, performer, everything. "But I'm not typical. No, folks, people have called me a type of Christ. Well, you be the judge. All I can tell you is that I am not from here. That was not a joke. I am not even from this world. There's no music today, no dancing girls, just me, a wonder worker. I come under the authority of the risen Lord, Nikolai Carpathia, and I have been imbued with power from him. If you are skeptical, let me ask you to look at the sky. I know the sun is still high and hot and bright, but would you agree with me that there are no clouds? None, not one. Anyone see one anywhere? On the distant horizon, forming somewhere in the great beyond? Shade your eyes, that's all right, but do me the favor of removing your sunglasses, those of you who have them. You're squinting, and that's all right. Some of you are frowning, but you won't be in a moment. Would you like a nice cloud, something to block the sun for just an instant? I can provide one. You're skeptical, I can tell. Don't look at me, you'll miss it. You'll think it was a trick. But what do you call that?" A shadow fell over the crowd. Even the GC gawked at the sky. Abdullah leaned over. Albie bent forward. Mac turned his body between them and looked up. A thick white cloud blotted out the sun. The people oohed and aahed. "How does he do that?" Abdullah said. "He already told you," Mac said. "Power from Nikolai." "Too quick," the miracle worker said. "Did the sudden change in temperature chill you, even out here in the desert? Maybe that's enough shade for the moment, hmm? The cloud disappeared. It didn't move, fade, or dissipate. It was there, and then it was gone. How about half shade, but still enough of the sun coming through to keep you warm? It was instantaneous. A woman near the stage dropped to her knees and began worshipping the man. Oh, ma'am, thank you ever so kindly, but what is the cliché? You have seen nothing yet? How about this microphone stand? A solid steel base, long two-piece shaft, separate microphone and cord attached at the top. Anyone want to come up and prove it is what I say it is? An older man limped up the steps to the platform. He felt the mic and stand, and then rapped on the upper shaft, causing thudding noises through the sound system. Oops, look at that, Miracle Man said. And the mic stand and mic had been replaced by a snake that led from his hand all the way to the transformer box. The people recoiled, and some cried out, but as quickly as it had appeared, the snake disappeared, and the mic and stand were as before. Magic tricks? You know better. Had trouble getting enough water lately? Or shall we believe the stories coming from inside Petra? Think a spring in there was an act of God? Then what does that make me? He pointed into the middle of the crowd, and a spring gushed from the ground, splashing over their heads. Cool, crisp, and refreshing, no? He said. Enjoy. Go ahead. And they did. Hungry? Tired of the fare in your new home? How about a basket of real bread, warm and chewy, and more than enough for all? He reached behind him and brought out a wicker basket with a linen napkin in it. 5 popover-sized chunks of bread, warm and golden brown, were piled in it. Start that around. Here you go. Sure, take one. No, a whole one. Take 2 if you'd like. There's more where that came from. The basket passed from hand to hand, and everyone took at least 1 piece, several 2, and yet the basket was never depleted. Who am I? Who do you say that I am? I am a disciple of the living Lord Potentate Carpathia. Have I persuaded you that he is all-powerful? His patience has run out with you people, however. He would like me to administer the mark of loyalty to you, which I can do without technology. You don't doubt me anymore, do you? People shook their heads. Who will be first? I will do 4 simultaneously. You, ask your friends what they see. Even Mac could see that they had Carpathia's mark on their foreheads. More? Yes, raise your hands. Now, those of you who have your hands raised right now, hear me. No new ones. Hands down if you didn't have them up when I said that. Why have you waited so long? What was the holdup? The one I serve wants me to slay you, and so you're dead. More than 100 dropped to the desert floor, causing the rest to shriek and cry out, Silence! You do not think I could slay the lot of you? If I can slay them, can I not also raise them? These 6 right up here, arise. The 6 stood as if they had just awakened. They looked embarrassed, as if they didn't know why they had been on the ground. Think they were merely sleeping, in a trance? All right. They're dead again. They dropped again. Now, if you know them, check their vital signs. He waited. No breath, no pulse, correct? Let that be a lesson to those who remain. You see that in the distance? Yes, there. A little cloud of dust, what appears to be tumbleweed rolling this way. Those are vipers of the deadliest sort. They are coming for you. Some turned and began to run, but they froze in place. No, surely you do not think escape is possible from one who can create a cloud to cover the sun. If you want the mark of loyalty, raise your hand now and receive it. The rest of the crowd raised their hands, frantic. But more of you should die before the vipers get here. About 36 keeled over.
Why do the vipers keep coming? A woman cried. We have all obeyed. We have all taken the mark.
The vipers are wise, that is all, he said. They know who was serious and loyal and who acted only out of fear for their lives. The spring turned to blood, and the people near it backed away. Fools, he said. You're all fools. Do you think a god like Nikolai Carpathia wants you as his subjects? No. He wants you dead and away from the clutches of his enemies. You are free to run now, and it is entertaining to me to see you run as fast and as frantically as you can. But let me warn you, you will not outrun the vipers. You will not reach Petra in time to save yourselves. Your bodies will lie bloated and baking in the sun until the birds have their way with your flesh. For as I leave, I take with me the shade I provided. The people burst from the scene, screaming and staggering madly in the sand toward Petra. The GC guards seemed apoplectic and stared as the vipers changed course to chase down the people. The spring dried up, the cloud disappeared, and dozens of chunks of bread lay in the sand. Mac looked at Albie and Smitty, and they all shook their heads, trembling. Suddenly the Wonder Worker stood directly in front of the chopper. Though he didn't open his mouth, Mac heard him as if he were inside the craft.
I know who you are. I know you by name. Your god is weak, and your faith a sham, and your time is limited. You shall surely die.
Mac had difficulty finding his voice.
Let's go,
he croaked, and Abdullah started the engines. The cloud of sand blew up and then away, and as Smitty lifted off, Mac looked down to see nothing but a long stretch of undisturbed sand, dotted only by the dead who had dropped at the sight. No GC, no Miracle Man, no platform, no bread, no vehicles. What about the snakes? He didn't see them either. But stretched for a quarter mile were the rest of the people, still and flat and grotesque on the desert floor, limbs splayed. Zion was troubled in his spirit by a deep sense of foreboding. He knew he wouldn't be able to shepherd all the way to the glorious appearing every person who had arrived in Petra. And yet he believed that when they had seen the mighty and miraculous hand of God, many of the undecided would be persuaded. Many had been. Of that there was no doubt. That was what Chaim and the other elders were saying as he despaired, deep in one of the caves. It was as if the Lord had told him that the rebels would not be returning, not any of them. But he didn't know if God would slay them, as he did in the Korah rebellion in the days of Moses, or whether Antichrist would kill them after luring them into the desert with his great deception. He looked up when Naomi hurried in from the Technology and Communications Center and went directly to her father. She stole a glance at Zion as she whispered in her father's ear, and when Zion saw the slump of his shoulders and the sad shaking of his head, he knew. The young woman left, and her father made his way up to Chaim. Zion leaned over. Tell us both. I must know of this eventually anyway.
But, sir, Naomi's father said, could you not be spared the totality of this until even one day after your triumph over the false prophet? Why must your rejoicing be tempered?
I am not rejoicing, my friend. I was unable to keep the false prophet from enticing the rebels to go their own way, no matter what I did or said. Tell me the whole of it. Spare me nothing.
Three of your friends from the Tribulation Force were eyewitnesses and are just now returning. They request a moment with you.
Zion stood.
Of course. Where are they?
On their way from the helipad. As he and Chaim neared the entrance to the cave, Mac, Albie, and Abdullah were coming in. They all embraced,
The elders maintained a respectful distance as the five huddled and Mac told the story.
"You should not have attended," Zion said sadly.
"If we'd known what we were going to see, we wouldn't have," Mac said. "But, you know, sometimes us pilot types are as curious as little boys. This just might have cured us."
"That man was not even human," Zion said. "Surely he was a demonic apparition. Revelation 12 says that when Satan, who will deceive the whole world, was cast down from heaven to earth, his angels were cast out with him. And, of course, it is no surprise that these people were not even recruited for the global community. John 10, verse 10, says Satan wants only to steal and to kill and to destroy."
"I have a question," Dr. Ben-Judah Albi said. "Is it okay not to like this? I mean, everybody's outraged about what happened, but just when I think I have an idea what God might be up to, he lets something like this happen and I don't understand him at all."
"Do not feel bad about that, my brother, unless your questioning of him makes you doubt him. He is in control. His ways are not our ways, and he sees a big picture we will not even be able to fathom this side of heaven. I, too, am distraught. I had so wished that some of these might run back to us, pleading that we intercede for them before God, the way the wayward children of Israel did in Old Testament times. I would have loved to pray for atonement for them, or to hold up an image of a bronze snake so that those bitten could look upon it and be healed. But God is doing his winnowing work. He is cleansing the earth of his enemies, and he is allowing the undecided to face the consequences of their procrastination. You know as well as I do that no one in his right mind should choose against the God who can protect them against weapons of mass destruction. But here were these fools venturing out into the desert, outside of God's blanket of protection, and there they lie. As the Apostle Paul put it, 'Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God! How unsearchable are his judgments, and his ways past finding out! For who hath known the mind of the Lord, or who hath been his counselor? For of him, and through him, and to him are all things, to whom be glory forever.'" Mac was up before dawn, eager to get going. But as he waited for Albi and Abdullah, he was aware of a buzz throughout Petra. An announcement was going out through an elaborate word-of-mouth system that Zion and Chaim were calling for everyone to assemble after they had eaten their morning manna. Abdullah and Albi ate quickly and packed, joining Mac with the million others before the three of them were to lift off. Chaim addressed the crowd first. "Zion believes the Lord has told him that no more indecision reigns in the camp. You may confirm that by looking about you. Is there anyone in this place without the mark of the believer? Anyone anywhere? We will not pressure or condemn you. This is just for our information." Mac made a cursory pan of the people within his vision, but mostly he watched Zion and Chaim, who waited more than 10 minutes to be sure. Then Zion stepped forward.
"The prophet Isaiah," he said, "predicted that it shall come to pass in that day that the remnant of Israel, and such as have escaped of the house of Jacob, will never again depend on him who defeated them, but will depend on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. The remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For though your people, O Israel, be as the sand of the sea, a remnant of them will return. And of the evil ruler of this world who has tormented you, Isaiah says further, 'It shall come to pass in that day that his burden will be taken away from your shoulder and his yoke from your neck, and the yoke will be destroyed. Praise the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The prophet Zechariah quoted our Lord God himself, speaking of the land of Israel, that 2/3 of it shall be cut off and die, but 1/3 shall be left in it. I will bring the 1/3 through the fire, will refine them as silver is refined, and test them as gold is tested. They will call on my name, and I will answer them. I will say, This is my people. And each one will say, The Lord is my God. My dear friends, you remnant of Israel, this is in accord with the clear teaching of Ezekiel chapter 37, where our barren nation is seen in the last days to be a valley of dry bones, referred to by the Lord himself as the whole house of Israel. They indeed say, Our bones are dry, our hope is lost, and we ourselves are cut off. But then, dear ones, God said to Ezekiel, Therefore prophesy and say to them, Thus says the Lord God, Behold, O my people, I will open your graves and cause you to come up from your graves and bring you into the land of Israel. I will put my spirit in you, and you shall live, and I will place you in your own land. Then you shall know that I, the Lord, have spoken it and performed it. It had been a long time since Rayford had done such hard physical labor. Even at Mizpeh Ramon, the building of the airstrip for Operation Eagle had largely been done under his supervision, but by others with heavy equipment. He was in charge of this operation, too, but there was no getting around that every pair of hands was crucial. Lionel Whalum had landed almost without incident at Gobernador Gregoris. The only trouble was that the main runway had been destroyed during the war, and the co-op had rebuilt it by duplicating it 100 feet parallel to the original. The GC were unaware of the rebuilding or of the huge encampment of underground believers who had been harvesting wheat and trading through the co-op ever since. But when the destroyed runway was discarded, which Rayford's main contact there, Luis Arturo, later told him had taken weeks to haul away, what was left was a smooth, dark depression in the ground. From the air, it looked as if the runway was still there. Luis had spent his high school and college years in the United States and spoke fluent, though heavily accented, English. He had had enough exposure to campus ministry groups that when he returned to Argentina and suffered through the disappearances, he knew exactly what had happened. He and some friends from childhood raced to their little Catholic church where hardly anyone was left. Their favorite priest and catechism teacher were gone, too. But from literature they found in the library, they learned how to trust Christ personally. Soon they were the nucleus of the new body of believers in that area. Luis proved to be an earnest, fast-talking man, and while he took especially to re-woo and was friendly and cordial to everyone, his top priority was getting the plane loaded and these men on their way again. All we hear are rumors that the GC is polluting the Chico and that they are on to us. He said, I have many reasons to believe that this is only the talk of the paranoid, but we cannot take chances. The time grows short anyway, so let's move. He seemed to like Ree so much because, though the South Korean was the youngest and smallest member of Rayford's crew, with the exception of George Sebastian, he proved to be in the best shape of everyone, Americans and Argentinians combined. Big George's reputation preceded him, and while he worked, lifting heavy sacks of wheat aboard the plane by himself, many of the South Americans tried to get him to talk about his imprisonment in Greece and his escape. Rayford noticed that George tried to downplay it. I overpowered a woman half my size. But she was armed, no? And she had killed people.
We couldn't let her keep doing that, could we?
Rayford worked, mostly alongside Lionel, each of them able to handle one sack of wheat at a time. Ree helped too, but he was young and fast and wouldn't feel it in the morning like Ray and Lionel would. After two solid days' work, thanks to hydraulic lift loaders and six aluminum pallets that held up to 30,000 pounds each, the wheat was nearly loaded and the plane partially full when Luis came running.
"Señor Steele, to the tower with me, quick! I have field glasses."
Rayford followed the young man to a new wooden two-story tower that had been designed to blend into the landscape. Aircraft had to watch for it, but nosy types unaware of it might not see it at all. Rayford had to catch his breath at the top of the stairs, but when he was ready, Luis passed him the binocs and pointed into the distance. It took Rayford a few seconds to adjust the lenses, but what he saw made him wonder if they were already too late and their work had been wasted. Chapter 19. Though it wasn't a long flight from Petra to India, Mac was sound asleep when Albie put the cargo plane down at Babatpur. With the delay at Petra, losing a couple of hours to time zones and the cumbersome plane, it was the middle of the night when they arrived. It took Mac a moment to get his bearings, but within seconds, he and Abdullah and Albie were rushed from the plane by the man known only as Bihari. Serious and no-nonsense, he said,
"Hurry, please. We remain about 100 miles north of the Rehen Dam."
100 miles? Mac said. "How are we getting this water back to the plane?"
"Trucks."
"The GC asleep over here, or what?"
"The GC, my friend, enjoy the drinking water."
Bihari averaged more than 70 miles an hour in a minivan that had no business going that fast on roads that may never have seen that speed before, especially in the dead of night. 90 minutes later, in a swirling cloud of dust, he swung into a clearing near a small processing plant and showed Mac and the others towering skids of bottled water that looked as if they would fill two large trucks.
"Where's the rest of it?" Mac said. "We got us a big, big plane."
"I wondered if you would notice," Bihari said.
"Did you not hear me honk at passing traffic on the way?"
"Occasionally, I guess."
"All but two trucks are already on their way to the plane. When we heard you were in the air, we got started. The prospect of real wheat to eat has motivated all of us. With you gentlemen and forklifts, we can load the last two trucks by dawn and be on our way."
A few minutes later, as Mac backed a forklift toward a stack of skids, he passed Albie.
"These people make me feel like a lazy old fool," he said. "Our job is cushy compared to theirs."
"They wouldn't want to worry about the missiles and bullets," Albie said. "They get away with this by supplying the GC with a little water?"
Bihari interrupted the last of the loading by waving his hands over his head at Mac.
"Will your people be discouraged by a setback?" he said.
"Depends," Mac said. "We still gonna be able to take off and get out of here?"
"Yes, but I believe we are doomed."
"That wouldn't make our day. What's the trouble?"
"We will drive by the dam on our way back to the airport. It is a little out of the way, but you must see it."
"I've seen dams before. Something wrong with yours?"
"My people tell me the next curse from the Lord has fallen."
"Uh-oh.
I cannot imagine what blood looks like being forced through the control doors of a dam."
"Me neither," Mac said. "How's your water inventory, minus what we're taking?"
"Maybe 6 months.
But the GC will surely raid us when they discover we no longer have sources either."
"They know where you are?"
"They have to have an idea. It will not take them long." "Hiding this place ought to be your top priority."
The sun was going down, and yet heat still shimmered off the plains of Argentina. Rayford tried to hold the binoculars still enough to make out what all the commotion was about. It could have been anything, but none of the options hit him as positive. There were an awful lot of people out there, that was sure,
but he couldn't quite tell if they were military, GC, morale monitors, peasants, people from the city, or what. He handed the glasses back to Luis. Do we just get in the air, or had we better check this out?
You know what I think?
Do we go armed? How many go with us?
Luis shook his head.
How about I supply the vehicle, and you supply the ideas?
Fair enough, Rayford said. Sebastian and I will go, and we will be armed, but not on the offensive. We're just seeing what's going on and keeping you and yours out of it. As they descended from the tower, Luis said,
Oh, dear Lord, I pray it hasn't already happened.
What's that?
Do you smell that, Captain Steele?
Rayford sniffed the air. Blood. Mac was preoccupied on the drive from the processing plant. Would the huge shipment of wheat have to be trucked all the way down here, too? Did they have enough trucks? And where would they store it? On the one hand, he worried about it, and on the other, he was glad it wasn't his problem. Better thinkers than he had put this deal together. It was their concern. When Bahari stopped at the dam, the other loaded truck pulled up behind. At first, no one disembarked. Then all four of them did. They just stood and watched for a minute. Two of the great doors in the wall of the dam were open, both disgorging huge arcs of liquid, splashing into a ravine and sweeping past them. Blood was so much thicker than water that it sounded and acted differently. It smelled awful, and Mac found it frightening somehow. It reminded him of a nightmare and chilled him. A man stood several hundred yards from the dam, downstream from the rushing blood. He looked familiar.
Who's that? Mac said, pointing.
Who is who? Albie said. Mac turned him the right direction and pointed.
I don't see so well this time of the morning, Mac. Who do you see?
No one sees that man by the rock down there. He's close to the river.
No one said anything.
I'm going to check him out. He's looking right at us, waving us down there.
I don't see him, Mac. Maybe this is one of your cowboy marriages.
Mac cocked his head at Abdullah.
One of my what?
One of those things you cowpokes see in the desert when you're thirsty. It looks like water, but it's just a cactus or something. A marriage.
Albie threw back his head and laughed.
I grew up 10,000 miles from Texas, and I know that one. It's a mirage, Smitty, a mirage.
Well, this isn't a marriage or a mirage, Mac said. I'll be right back.
He drew within 100 yards of the man, who watched him all the way.
If you're gonna come, the man said, why not bring an empty bottle?
What do I want a bottle of blood for? Anyway, I don't think I have an empty one.
Empty one and bring it.
Mac turned around as if it was the most normal request, and he had no choice. As he hurried back, Abdullah said,
So what was it, partner?
A marriage?
Very funny, camel jockey.
Mac pulled a bottle from one of the skids, drank half of it on his way back, then poured out the rest.
Hey, Bahari called. That stuff's as valuable as wheat, you know.
Mac watched his footing as he reached the rushing crimson tide.
You get around, don't you, Michael?
He said.
You omnipresent or something?
You know better than that, Cleburne, Michael said. Like you, I am on assignment.
And coincidentally, in the same part of the world as me. I never got to thank you for...
Michael held up a hand to silence him, then reached for the bottle. He sighed and looked to the sky. He spoke softly, but with great passion.
Great and marvelous are thy works, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints. Who shall not fear thee, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou only art holy, for all nations shall come and worship before thee, for thy judgments are made manifest.
Michael carefully walked among the rocks down to the edge of the rushing river.
The surging blood was so loud that Mac worried he wouldn't be able to hear Michael if he spoke again. And as if he knew Mac's fear, Michael turned and beckoned him closer. Mac hesitated. Michael was being spotted with blood. His brown robes were speckled, as were his beard and face and hair. "Come," he said, and Mac went. Michael stood with one foot on a rock and the other just inches from the river. He said,
"Thou art righteous, O Lord, which art and wast and shall be, because thou hast judged thus. For they have shed the blood of saints and prophets, and thou hast given them blood to drink, for they are worthy."
Then another voice, Mac didn't know from where.
"Even so, Lord God Almighty, true and righteous are thy judgments."
Michael bent low and thrust the bottle into the current. The rushing blood pushed against his arm and soaked his sleeve and filled the bottle. And when he drew it from the river and turned toward Mac, there was no blood on him. His robe was dry, his face was clean, his arm was clean. The bottle was full of pure, clean water. Michael handed it to Mac. "Drink," he said. Mac put the cold bottle to his lips and tipped it straight up. As Mac closed his eyes and drank it all, Michael said, "Jesus said, whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst, but the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life." Mac opened his eyes and exhaled loudly. Michael was gone.
"All due respect, sir," Sebastian said, "but you realize it's just you and me, a couple of guns and a few rounds of ammunition, and we don't have a clue what we're driving into."
"I was hoping you'd protect me," Rayford said. "This military stuff is fairly new to me."
"We're not really going to take these people on, are we?"
"I hope not, George. We're hopelessly outnumbered."
"Sort of what I was getting at, sir."
"Let's just play this out and see what we find."
Hold on. Could you stop a second?"
"You serious?"
"Yes, sir."
Rayford stopped and put the vehicle in park.
"You didn't read that in some military strategy book, did you?"
"What's that?"
"The see what we find gambit."
"George, listen. Nothing is as it used to be. We improvise every day. You're a living example of that. We have no choice here. We've got a whole bunch of our brothers and sisters trying to survive out here, and now something could be threatening them. If I went back and got all of them and armed all of them, they would be no match for the GC if they decided to advance. So let's see what this is. We shouldn't have to get right into the middle of it before we know we should turn back. Use the binocs. You see armed GC, say the word, and we turn around. Fair enough?" George looked like he was thinking. "Consider this," he said. "See over there, over your other shoulder. There's a big group of somebody heading toward the gathering place. Let's go wide around the back way and get into that group. They aren't military and they aren't threatening."
"Makes sense."
"Always does. Make use of your resources."
"Like your mind, you mean?" Rayford said.
"Well, I wasn't going to say that." Mac looked around, his heart stampeding as if he had run up a mountainside. He scampered down to the rushing river of blood and plunged the bottle into the current. Blood splashed all over him, but when he pulled the bottle out, it was pure fresh water again. He laughed and shouted and charged back toward Albi and Abdullah and Bahari. But they had apparently never seen Michael and quickly tired of Mac's antics.
"You didn't see him? You didn't, did you?"
They looked at him gravely from the trucks.
"Did you see me pour the water out? Well, did you? Bahari, you did, because you told me it was worth its weight in wheat. Remember? Well, then where did I get this?"
Bahari got out of the truck.
"Where did you get that?" he said.
"From that river right there. And do you see any blood on me?"
"I don't."
"Still think you're doomed? The GC is going to leave you alone when they see what's happened to your water source, but you send your people and your equipment down here like usual. God takes care of the ones he's sealed. Amen?"
By now, Albie and Abdullah had come to see as well.
"Try a taste of this, gentlemen. You'll want to drink it all, but it's for sharing."
Rayford and George found themselves in the middle of a pilgrimage of some sort. Almost everyone else was on foot. From their clothes, they appeared to be both town and country folk and some peasants.
"English, anyone?" George said.
Two more times he said it, and finally a man, who appeared to be with his wife and perhaps a couple of other family members, came alongside the vehicle.
"English?" "Yes," he said.
"Where are we going?" George said.
"We are going where we have been invited," the man said.
"All of you? Invited?"
"I do not know about the others. We were invited."
"Who invited you?"
"Three men. They came to the door and told us to meet them out here, and they would tell us good news."
"But you are not Carpathia loyalists," George said. "I see no mark."
"On you either, sir," the man said, "and yet you seem no more afraid than we do."
"You don't even seem concerned," George said.
"The men told us not to fear."
"Why did you believe them? What gave you such confidence?"
"They were believable. What can I say?"
"Ask some others why they are here."
The man spoke to another group in Spanish, then to another.
"We were all invited by the same men," he said.
"And who are they?"
"No one knows.
And yet they all risk their lives to be here."
"It is as if we have no choice, sir."
Rayford stopped, and the crowd surged past him.
"What does this sound like to you, George?"
"The same thing it sounds like to you. Ming's story."
"Exactly.
And we'll know for sure from the first words that come from their mouths. If the one Christopher..."
"Right.
Starts out with the gospel, and the next one predicts what's going to happen to Babylon."
"Nahum."
"Right.
And Caleb warns about taking the mark. Well, that's all we need to know."
"But where's the GC, Rayford? These guys got people saved in China, but the peacekeepers still killed them." Both men turned in their seats to watch for the enemy.
"Maybe God and these guys work differently in different parts of the world."
Leah Rose worked in the basement of Lionel Whalum's huge home in Long Grove, Illinois. She and Hannah were making an inventory of medical supplies and a list of what was needed at various co-op locations. They were working with printouts from Chloe Williams.
"I'm looking for a place that needs more than supplies, frankly," Leah said.
"I hear you. Is anything more exhausting than being idle? I don't know if I want to be in the middle of combat again, but I've got to be somewhere I'm needed."
"Problem is," Leah said, "Petra doesn't need medicine or nurses, but I'd like to at least stop by there on the way to my next assignment."
"Really? Wonder who? I mean, wonder why?"
"Shut up, Hannah."
Suddenly, Leah's knees buckled and she almost fell.
"What was that?" Hannah said. "You all right?"
"Yeah, I don't know. I just went weak all of a sudden, but it passed."
But as soon as she had said that, she dropped to her knees.
"Leah!"
"I'm okay. It's just that I... Oh, God. Yes. I will, Lord. Of course."
"What? What is it?"
"Pray with me, Hannah. We're supposed to pray for Mr. Whalum."
"Should I get his wife?"
"We're supposed to do it right now."
"Lord,"
Leah said, "I don't know what you're impressing upon me except that Mr. Whalum needs prayer right now. We trust you, we love you, we believe in you, and we know you are sovereign.
Do whatever you have to do to keep him safe and all those who are with him. He and Rayford and George and Ree should be leaving soon, so give them whatever they need, protect them in whatever way they need protection, and go before them into India.
Here they come, Rayford said, pointing past the west end of the crowd to show George the GC. They pulled up in jeeps and vans, maybe 100 troops, uniformed and armed. They had bullhorns. While Rayford drove to the other side of the crowd and parked where he could see the people, the GC, and the front of the assembly, a GC officer announced, "This is an unlawful assembly. You are violating the law. There is no facility here for administering the mark of loyalty, and you are so many months past now that you will not be allowed to rectify that oversight. Appearing in public without the mark of loyalty is punishable by death at the hands of any law-abiding citizen, but if you will disperse now and go directly back to your homes, we will offer a brief extension and allow you to take the mark within 24 hours. An application site is available as close as Tamil Ike or Laguna Grande, both within 60 miles of here." The people did not stop, did not look, did not appear troubled. The GC began again. "This is your last warn..."
"Silence!"
The commanding voice came from the front, from one of the three, and without amplification. "My name is Christopher, and I speak under the authority of Jesus Christ the Messiah and Son of the Living God. He has determined that those of this company who receive his everlasting gospel today shall enter into his millennial kingdom at his glorious appearing just over 2 years from now." The people began to murmur, and the GC were on their bullhorns again, but the horns malfunctioned and no one could hear them. "My co-workers Nahum and Caleb are here with me, only to proclaim that which the Lord has assigned us to proclaim. And then God's message of salvation as found in his only begotten Son will be presented by one of the 144,000 witnesses he has raised up from the tribes of the children of Israel. And now be gone, you workers of iniquity! You servants of the evil ruler of this world, you shall come nigh unto these people and this place never again. Begone, lest the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ strike you dead where you stand." The GC ran for their vehicles and for their lives. Christopher said, "Fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come. And worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and springs of water." Nahum followed with his curse on Babylon, and Caleb warned of the consequences of accepting the mark of the beast. Then a white-robed evangelist strode to the front and said, "There shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. And when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh."
"Wheat's a-comin', and you've got water galore, Bahari. Excuse me while I make a phone call."
Mac punched in Rayford's number.
"Ray, where you at, man? When you guys heading this way?" "Good. Listen, you've seen the rivers?" "That's right. You're on the Chico. Let me tell you, it doesn't affect the believers. At least it doesn't here."
He told him of his encounter with Michael and what had happened to the blood.
"We're about an hour from taking off, so tell those brothers and sisters the water is coming." "Well, that's right. They don't need it that bad now, do they? Bahari here is looking at me like I've just lost it. Well, hey, You tell him a deal's a deal.
Can I tell him, Captain Steele? George said.
Tell who what?
Luis, about the GC having to leave this area alone, and about the water.
Like to share good news, do you?
You bet. Knock yourself out.
When they got back, Luis jogged up to the car. Well?
George wants the privilege, Rayford said. We roll in 10 minutes. Lionel would take the first 4 hours, then Ree would take over, but Rayford would land the craft. Ray was strapping into the co-pilot's chair when Lionel fired up the engines, but as he put his headphones on, he sensed something wrong.
You okay? Rayford said.
Lionel pressed his lips together.
Did all my pre-flight.
Me too, so?
Doesn't feel right.
Long flight, big plane, lots of cargo, friend.
We don't go till you're happy here.
I appreciate that, but I can't put my finger on it.
Want to do pre-flight again? Check every box from top to bottom, just to be sure?
Nah, just let me think a minute.
Rayford turned in his seat.
How you doing, Ree?
Ree gave him a thumbs up and lay his head back as if ready to sleep.
Here comes your last crew member, Mr. Pilot. Should he shut the door or are we holding?
Aw, nuts. Hold a second, I'm checking the cargo.
Need help?
Nah, I got it.
Cold back there.
Don't I know it.
Rayford waited just past 10 minutes. Ree and George were strapped in and dozing already.
Ray unstrapped and started back to the cargo hold when he met Lionel coming the other way.
All set?
Lionel gave him a look.
Tell the tower we're ready.
As they strapped back in, Lionel looked at Rayford again.
Praise God is all I've got to say.
No, it isn't.
Tell me.
Had a whole pallet that never got secured. First bank, it would have shifted.
Could have put us down.
Course.
Surely you'd check the cargo on pre-flight.
I did. I always do. Hardly anything's more important than keeping that load centered and secure.
What made you think of it?
I have no idea. I double-checked every lock. All were up. I just got a feeling I should check again.
Well, buddy, Rayford said, if we land in India, that feeling will be the reason.
Chapter 20. 5 years into the tribulation.
Chang spent hours monitoring the palace, his ears always perking up when he heard Carpathia.
Something in the atmosphere of that ancient Edom region interferes with our missiles, our flights, our artillery, Nikolai said one evening. The entire area has become a Bermuda Triangle. Ensure the peace, but do not waste another nick on armory that does no more than what we can accomplish diplomatically.
Chang knew global community diplomacy was an oxymoron. Standard operating procedure no longer included any semblance of public relations for the potentate. Someone was trying to protect the potentate from it, but from all over the globe came evidence that even the millions of citizens who bore marks of loyalty to him now knew that the risen god of the world had become a despot king. Hundreds of thousands were dying everywhere for want of drinkable water. One report from Region 7, the United African States, showed a woman railing in public before a small, obviously fearful crowd.
Justice, fair play, even juries are relics from another time. We obey the GC and bow to the image of the supreme ruler only because we all know someone who has been put to death for failing to.
She was shot to death where she stood, and the crowd scattered for its life. From the same area came a sham of a recording depicting a programmed parade for the benefit of the Global Community News Network. The people marched listlessly, their faces blank, as they held aloft placards and chanted, "Hail Carpathia!" in monotones. Chang both suffered and benefited from the chaos at the palace. In many ways, New Babylon had become a ghost town.
Citizens could no longer afford pilgrimages to the gleaming edifices. He knew from the real figures, not the cooked books whose summaries were announced to the populace, that half the world's population at the time of the rapture had now died. The capital city of the world didn't work very well anymore. Factions and mini-kingdoms sprang up, even around Carpathia, top people threatening, cajoling, surrounding themselves with sycophants. Everyone was suspicious of everyone else, while all were obsequious and cloying around the big boss. Revolt was out of the question. Theirs was a ruler who had proved himself impervious to death. What was the point of killing him again? You could take power for 3 days, but you had better loot the place and be gone when he resurrected. The sad state of services in New Babylon was nothing compared to everywhere else in the world but Petra. Trib Force and Co-op flyers reported that everywhere they went they saw that things simply wore out and were not replaced. The huge depletion of the population cost society half the people once employed in service jobs. Few were left to transport fuel, fix cars, keep street lamps and traffic lights working, maintain order, protect businesses. Buck recounted in The Truth that the GC, especially at the local level, used